Thank you, Karen, and thank you to Neighbors for Peace and everybody who's helped me out today and set up this event. And it's great to see a bunch of friends here. And it's, you know, it's not such a huge crowd that I think we couldn't talk orally, but I guess we're going to write down questions since the microphone doesn't pick up the questioning. And I'll try to answer everybody's questions, and I'll try not to talk too terribly long first. But I'm reminded in mention of ACORN that we used to have, well, still have, but I used to work with a very good chapter of ACORN here in Chicago. And there was a winter, several winters back now, it was extremely cold, and President George W. Bush was insisting on cutting the funding for people's heat and air conditioning in warmer climates, the LIHEAP funding, L-I-H-E-A-P was the acronym. And we had a lot of members in apartments in Chicago who were in danger of actually freezing to death, and a number of people actually freezing to death. And so we had quite a crowd of people, including a lot of senior citizens, go to the Republican Party's office, the Illinois Republican Party's office here, and move in with sleeping bags and blankets and pillows and announce their intention to live there, and took the place over. People would call on the phone and they would answer ACORN. And they, well, I was trying to reach the Republican. Well, this is ACORN. We've taken over the Illinois Republican. Oh my God! You know, and now this was the day before Bush was coming to Chicago to announce his big plan to save the economy by cutting more taxes, and the only story, the only image in the news in Chicago that morning as Bush showed up was senior citizens being piled into paddy wagons for not having heat in their apartments, right? Outside of the Republic. Well, the funding for LIHEAP that year in Washington, shortly after this state, went up. Didn't go down. It went up significantly. We also, I remember, had a national convention of ACORN members from around the country here. Must have been around 2002 or so. And it was right here, or it was at Loyola. It was, I don't remember. It was right along the river, the lake. And one of the things we did, you know, we had a huge march through downtown about immigrants' rights and workplace rights and so forth. But we also were interested in this corporation that was based here called Household Finance, which you won't hear anything about anymore. But this was one of the biggest mortgage lending companies in the country. And they were making what we had created the term for and we called predatory loans. They were making loans to people with the intention, mostly refinance loans, to take people's houses away from them with the intention that they not be able to pay them back, and refinancing for more fees and taking their house. And so we had people from around the country who had lost their homes to this company. And their CEO and their board members all lived just north of here in some enormous palaces. And we had tried everything, right? We had got major state pension plans to divest. We had gotten legislation in cities and in states and were moving it in Congress. And every time we had a hearing, we used victims of this company, you know, and we had our loan counselors getting people out of this company's loans and getting them into good loans and steering everybody away. We had advertisements about them. We had national days of sit-ins in all their offices everywhere. We had every strategy you could imagine. But, you know, we didn't really break them. They weren't ready to talk until we went just north of here with hundreds of people on buses who had lost their homes around the country to this company and put hundreds of people simultaneously on the front lawns of these people's houses, the board members and the CEOs, and knocked on the doors and said, you know, our friends are putting up these wanted posters with your faces and your crimes all around this nice neighborhood for your neighbors to see, as we were, and we'd like to talk to you about whether we can get our houses back, you know. They came to the table, they sat down, they wanted to talk about nothing other than what we did on their front lawns, and they forked over $500 million with a B which, you know, was not what they'd taken, but was the largest settlement other than the tobacco companies that anybody's ever seen. And so you ask, you know, why would there be these fraudulent video pimp campaigns and these attacks on Acorn and this pretense that Acorn caused the Wall Street disaster, when if they'd listened to us, there wouldn't have been the Wall Street disaster? Because we were succeeding. Right? When you see somebody getting attacked, it's because they are succeeding. It's because they're a threat. And there's a hell of a lot of success around that you don't hear about. And one way to spot it is to look at who's being attacked. So I appreciate being reminded about Acorn. The situation in the country right now is one where polls show about 90% of Americans think our government in Washington is broken. Right? And 80% of Democrats oppose the Supreme Court's decision on corporate money in elections, and 80% of Republicans oppose the same decision. That's universal as far as polling goes. You don't get better than 80-90%. That's everybody. So public opinion isn't as badly broken as we think. And public activism isn't even as badly broken as we think. And I've seen more activism following this Supreme Court ruling in this Citizens United case than in the previous 2 years. And a lot of it is across the political spectrum. But the activism is pretty broken, and it's pretty far behind the opinions as told to pollsters, and it's absolutely right that the government is broken. Right? You look at the Washington Post today and you read about this attack on this city of Marja in Afghanistan being for purposes of influencing domestic opinion in the United States. It was not strategic, didn't make any sense to attack this city. Some 50,000 people, you know. So every time you hear about another couple dozen civilians accidentally killed, you know, that's not the sad but inevitable result of war, with war understood as something acceptable for some reason. That's the sad inevitable result at best of a PR campaign. That's how bad our government is broken. And it's not a successful PR campaign, not there, not here. People understand that we have to do something about putting all our energy and all our money and all our resources into these wars. And, you know, fundamentally the problem is that we can't unelect anybody anymore. We can't take somebody who wants to be reelected and unelect them. All right? And you know, it's the money, it's the media, it's the parties, it's the election machines, it's the ballot access and the debate access, it's all the corruption that we know about. And one route, you know, to take is to have corporations fund a movement against this machine of corporate power and have people get mad and say hateful things and become racist and hate immigrants and gay people and steer all the anger away from the corporations into, you know, attacking the government as incompetent, shrink everything other than the military, and, you know, steer it away from the war machines and the corporations and do things that are just out of anger but don't actually impact anything. You know, talk about term limits for Congress members, or don't let them have health care until we can have health care, just to be mean to them, you know. And it's a kind of thinking that's not strategic and doesn't come out of a democratic attitude with a small d, right? I mean, if you want term limits, you want to take away the only hope we possibly have, which is them worrying about what we think next year, right? We've come to think of the American public as yet another corrupting force because the elections have been so corrupted. And yet our only hope is to make the elections something that we have control over and make them afraid that we'll unelect them next time. You know, not term limiting them out and putting in another person who does the same thing. A second approach, which is a very common one, I think, is to critique the first approach. You know, when the Republicans were in power, all the left-wing and liberal and progressive and Democratic Party media outlets just talked about the Republicans all the time. And now they still do. It's all they talk about, right? Because it's the only way to make them look acceptable by comparison. It's a little known fact, we've completely voted the Republicans out of power. They are out of power in Washington, and yet we talk about nothing else. So that's a second approach, is to talk about them, to put some, mildly progressive reforms on the table and nudge things in the right direction and give a pass to anybody who's in the Democratic Party. And then the third approach that I would recommend is not some sort of compromise between those, but is to actually take our government seriously and take it over and use it. And use it for things we don't even dare imagine using it for. And the steps to do this, I think, include, number one, enforcing laws. Number two, making better laws through better activism. And number three, not being defeatist and discouraging and so forth. And I started out this book tour, talking about what needs to be done, how do we do it, what's going on in Washington, and I gradually evolved over a period of months into, being a public therapist for people's discouragement and despair, which, I had never seen until the latter part of last year, which came almost entirely out of this, but we elected a different guy president and everything isn't perfect now and that's disappointing, which is absolutely crazy, right? I think Emma Goldman had it right when she said if voting changed things, it would be outlawed. It doesn't by itself change anything. And to be discouraged that it doesn't, and to take a candidate for office and imagine that for the first time in history he's going to keep all his promises without even being pushed to do it, and he's going to keep all the promises that we just fantasize he's secretly making. He's secretly, tens of millions of Americans absolutely convinced he's secretly plotting to be better than what he's campaigning on. Absolutely unheard of phenomena. And then to be disappointed that that didn't happen is just craziness. So I have some copies of a magazine, the Humanist magazine, the latest issue that has an article from me that's all pep talk, and I'm just going to leave that there and skip it because it depresses me, and I'd rather move on to what do we do. Because really, people are encouraged to do more when they see people doing things, not when they're told anything. You can't talk somebody into being motivated. You have to just show them, and it's a lot. It's our moral responsibility, as all of you know, since you're here, and it's much more fun than sitting home and complaining, and it's good for your health. There are medical studies that will show you that activism and resistance is good for your health, so, listen to your doctor. So enforcing laws. Mr. Yu and Mr. Bybee, according to every newspaper in the country yesterday, are essentially torture lawyers and have been let off the hook and there will be no punishment for them. And this is tragic and disappointing, but this is a fact because it was on every television and in every newspaper. And it's absolute nonsense. Absolutely nonsense. They are not torture lawyers to begin with. Why would I say they're not torture lawyers? It's like calling Al Capone a tax cheat. To call these guys torture, it is something you can nail them on, and by God, you should. These people authorized aggressive war at the whim of any president outside of any system of law, outside of Congress or the courts or you or me. There's a million dead bodies of blood on their hands. And we're worried about torture, right? And Mr. Yu goes to a lecture like this and somebody asks him, can the president crush a kid's testicles? Oh yeah, sure, the president can crush it. And the biggest, most scandalous thing Mr. Yu has ever done. Well, in this report that came out from the Justice Department that supposedly lets them off the hook, he says the president can massacre a village. Oh sure, why not? The president can massacre a village, another village. There's not a limit to what the president can do. Now, today, he ups it a little more. He says the president can nuke cities. A president can nuke cities. And again, it's not one city, not two cities, not a certain size city. Any city. There is not a limit on what a president can do when it's wartime, and it is always wartime. That is what these people have done. And when you nuke the city, when you massacre the village, the testicles die with the rest of the person. You know, it, torture is a footnote to what these people have done. And there wasn't any hook for them to be let off of. You know, there was a question of whether the Justice Department was going to whitewash this report from years back and say they didn't commit any misconduct. Well, and they did that. But they also put out the early versions of the report so you can see all the horrors and the conclusion that they're guilty of misconduct and should be referred for disbarment. And even the final version says it's up to the bar associations whether they are disbarred. Of course it is. And it's up to Congress whether Mr. Bybee is impeached. If President Nixon had got some hack to put out a report that said Nixon will not be impeached, and then the Washington Post, after all that Watergate reporting, had said, oh, well, it's too bad, but Nixon's off the hook. He won't be impeached now because he has a report that says so. It's craziness. You know, the Congress is independent. The bar associations are independent. Go to disbartorturelawyers.com and help push to disbar these people. Go to impeachbybee.org and help push to impeach Mr. Bybee. They're going to hold hearings. Senator Leahy is going to hold hearings on Friday on torture lawyers. It's all going to be about torture, you and Bybee. And who's going to not be there who might be relevant? You and Bybee. In 2007 and 2008, Congress subpoenaed dozens of people. If somebody subpoenas you, and you tell them you have to go golfing or shoe shopping, or they can go Cheney themselves, you go to jail. Not these people. Dozens of top officials, including the vice president, subpoenaed, and they told Congress to go to hell, and Congress said, sorry, I bothered you. In 2009, 2010, how many of these people have been re-subpoenaed? Nobody. Nobody. And in April, when these torture memos came out, and Senator Leahy said to Jay Bybee, who got to be a judge, who has a lifetime seat on an appeals court by writing these memos, that was the bargain, he says, Mr. Bybee, would you mind coming in and talking to the United States Senate? It's down the street from the White House. It's a big white thing. You might have heard of us. And Bybee told him to go to hell. And he said, I'm sorry I bothered you. And that was that. Because they do not have the power of subpoena anymore. Do you raise your hand if you know what inherent contempt is? Lobo knows. Anybody else? It's a feeling in your stomach when Karl Rove comes on the television, right? Inherent contempt. There's one good definition, but the technical definition is, for the better part of U.S. history, when a congressional committee wanted somebody to show up and say things, and they didn't want to show up, they literally held them in contempt in a jail cell on Capitol Hill until they testified to the satisfaction of the committee. You don't need both houses. You don't need either house. You only need a committee. Any committee has the right, undisputed by anyone, to send the Capitol Police Force to literally hold in contempt any of these people until they testify to the satisfaction of the committee. That's not just, I do not recall, sir, I do not recall, sir, right? And you look back at how it used to work, and it looks medieval, and they would bring a guy in just to apologize for offending the dignity of Congress, which was thought of as having dignity, and it looks funny, but at least they cared. And it was inherent because it was understood as self-preservation, the inherent right of the first branch of our government to preserve its existence. And then they made a statute 75 years ago, we'll have the Justice Department enforce contempt citations, and then when Bush and Cheney are in town, they start subpoenaing employees and former employees of the Justice Department. And how'd that work out? And then they take them to court, there's a real branch of government, we'll take them to court, but they don't have the nerve to enforce a subpoena. And so you're going to see Leahy and Conyers, unless you and Bybee choose to show up, you're going to see Leahy and Conyers holding hearings on the torture lawyers without the torture lawyers. And you're not going to see Conyers impeach Jay Bybee unless we force some changes. And we impeached a judge this year, last year, for groping people. And we're impeaching a judge right now for petty corruption, right? And that the nation's not going through any kind of trauma. You know, we've impeached lots of people in U.S. history. And Jay Bybee's name is at the bottom of memos legalizing aggressive war and torture. And he's not being impeached. So we have to be going after the Judiciary Committee and every Congress member with this demand. And ultimately, we have to get to prosecution, because even if they get disbarred, even if Bybee gets impeached or is forced to resign, it's not going to be enough deterrence. You know, this is why you go after past crimes, as they call them. Raise your hand if you know what percentage of crimes are past crimes.
100%. Unless I'm committing a crime now.
Right. Outside of Tom Cruise movies, all the crimes that we prosecute are past crimes. So if looking forward is going to be our new presidential method of law enforcement, we're not going to enforce any laws. We're not going to prosecute any crimes. They're all past crimes. And the crimes are ongoing. The illegal aggressive wars, the lawless imprisonment, the warrantless spying, the torture is all ongoing because it's not being prosecuted. And it's not being prosecuted because it's ongoing. And the president controls the Justice Department, and the president controls the Congress. We have to at least, these are simple and very public facts, but we have to at least come to an understanding of what's happening so we can take it on. And John Yoo is among the happiest Americans with the conduct of the new president in these areas, and especially with the expanded use of unmanned drones, right? Not with how precise they are, but with how radically illegal they are. He's just thrilled with it. But he's also happy with the president's use of all of the expanded powers that I talk about quite a lot in the book, including the power to make laws, and the power to spend money, and the power to operate in secrecy, and the power to make war, and the power of retroactive immunity. You know, we've put almost all power in the hands of presidents, and it's extremely dangerous. And we have people saying, end the wars, Mr. President. And we have people saying, no, expand the wars, Mr. President. And they are both equally catastrophically dangerous and stupid things to say. Because as long as presidents have the power to make wars, you will have wars. And you know, this is one where 225 years ago, the people who wrote the documents to form this country were ahead of us and understood this perfectly and set up a system of government ideally designed to prevent it. And we've destroyed it. So we have to get these powers away from the president into Congress and get Congress to listen to us. The power of war now, you know, now claimed in Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speeches, among other places, means that these threats to Iran that we're now hearing have to be taken as seriously as ever. The work that a lot of you did to educate the public on the lies that took us into Iraq was incredible, and the public became aware of war lies and opposed a war because of the lies in an unprecedented way. But that's years ago now, and it's out of the news, and the threats to Iran are still being pushed harder and harder. And you know, one of the articles of impeachment that was introduced against Cheney was for the crime of threatening a war on Iran, which effectively the White House press secretary did last week when he said, yeah, that's one of the options on the table that we're considering, which was not new. I mean, they said that years ago, but said it again last week. But Cheney is out there bragging about his crimes on television routinely. You know, the current administration is working overtime to protect him and cover up his crimes, and he's out there bragging about them. And his crimes dwarf you and Bibee's. I mean, he was in charge of the war lies, of the war policies, of the torture, of the spying, of the retribution, and the outing of CIA agents, and profiteering off a war that he started. Not to mention refusing a subpoena. So how do we, what do we do? How do we do things better? And what do we want to create in Washington? I think most of what we're doing is a waste of energy, really an immoral waste of energy. I mean, we love to laugh at these right-wingers or lament and feel sorry for them who, you know, support candidates who want to give all their money to billionaires and enrich the top 3% of Americans and support them because they say bad things about gay people or black people or abortions or whatever, and they're bought off in this way. But, you know, look at how many Democratic Party supporters are putting all their time and money and energy for over a year into the hope that so-called health care reform might have a so-called public option that will be privately determined and the prices set privately and is expected to reach, yes, 3% of Americans. It's an incredible, immoral waste. And, you know, to call it public and then to act as if it's worthy of all of our energy is crazy. When there are serious campaigns for civilized healthcare systems making good progress in several states, Canada got it in provinces first, it's gonna happen in states first, and it's much easier for us to do most things in states, and easier than that, to do them in cities. You know, California has passed single-payer healthcare 3 times. They just need a governor that they can force to sign it. There are good bills advancing in Pennsylvania and Ohio and Minnesota and North Carolina and New Mexico, Missouri. There are candidates for governor and lieutenant governor campaigning on it. There is going to be good health care in this country. It's just going to come through the states first, and that's true with most things, you know, and it's true even on issues like peace. You know, we have a good campaign for a Department of Peace at the national level. It's not about to happen. We should do it at the state levels, and we should have states bring the National Guard home, defend those who refuse illegal orders, work to discourage domestic violence, work on peace issues at the local level. We should have these things happening where we can make them happen. Now, for one thing, because the changes that we're going to need at the national level have to be done through the states at this point, because we have to amend the Constitution. You know, we have this cutting-edge document 2.25 centuries ago that is dragging behind so many treaties and so many nations' constitutions, and we've barely touched the thing. You know, we had 12 amendments originally. Eventually, we got 11 of them. We have another 16. Over 2.25 centuries, one of them to get rid of alcohol, another one to bring it back, several of them to tweak how you elect presidents. You know, we have almost not improved our government, our basic structure of government, in over 2 centuries, and we've never, ever yet had a convention to fix the thing. And so whether we do amendments through Congress and then get 3/4 of the states to approve, or we do it through getting states to start a convention and then get 3/4 of the states to approve, we have to have good organization and good control of our state governments, and we can get it. You know, in terms of Washington, the money is going to be the hardest. The media is, you know, it's hard and it's easy because the big reforms are going to take time, but supporting better media and ceasing to support bad media is easily done by everybody right now. And the party corruption, I think, is the easiest. You know, and it's connected. Most of the money goes through the parties, and that's most of their power. But we've reached a point where there's almost two voices in Washington instead of 535. You know, almost nobody ever does what their constituents want when the leadership of their party tells them not to, and really tells them not to. Are we in Congresswoman Schakowsky's district by any chance? Jan Schakowsky today put in a bill to get rid of mercenaries, which, you know, is absolutely the right thing to do. We can't have privatized soldiers outside any rule of law fighting wars outside any control by us or Congress or courts. It's crazy, it's wasteful, it's murderous, it's immoral. And why was she able to put in that bill? Why didn't the president say, I'll ruin your career if you put in that bill? Because it won't pass. Because there's a snowball's chance in hell of it getting out of the House, worse than that in the Senate, and if the president doesn't want to sign it, he'll veto it. But last summer, Jan Schakowsky, after having voted against war money again and again and again for years because she opposed the wars, she told us, said, I'm going to vote for war money now because my president wants me to. The executive, the guy we call the executive who's supposed to execute the will of the Congress, he tells Congress what to do. And Jan Schakowsky says, I'm going to vote for war money now because my president wants me to. And she's got some of the best constituents I know, but they should not have allowed her a moment of peace from last June until now for that. There's always this talk, you know, of bipartisanship or even of post-partisanship, you know, which I think boils down to don't let the one party be any better than the other party. And I'm more inclined to refer people to pre-partisanship, that is to point to 1789 through 1801 when we got along just fine without the two parties. Damn it, thank you. We didn't need them. You know, what developed in 1801, this system of having two parties run everything that's been increased from that point to this, where we now really have two parties instead of three branches, and having a president run one of the parties, and having the Supreme Court be the ultimate deciders of what's the law, all of that has to be undone. We have to, you know, it's very tempting to say, well, let's just have a third party that'd be better than the other two, right? But, you know, the reforms that would make that possible, the fixing the money and the media and the ballot and the election, vote counting and all the rest of it, you know, would make independent candidates possible who don't answer to any party and would clean up the existing parties. And when you have a system where it's winner take all, it's winner take all for the presidency where you've put all the power, and it's winner take all in any given congressional race, and the president is elected separately from the legislature, it very much encourages having either two parties or no parties. Three parties, four parties, five parties is very hard. And when all the power is in the White House, if you have three or four or 18 parties in the legislature is just not going to do anything. Because any party that doesn't have the White House is just going to oppose anything until they can get the White House. I think our ideal should be that Jan Schakowsky answers to her constituents and not the leader of any party, no matter what party, no matter how much better that party is. You know, this can point us, I think, toward thinking about reducing party power as one of the angles we can take. I've seen thousands of approaches to undoing this Supreme Court decision. I haven't seen anybody talk about reducing the power of the parties to control their elected members. I think we have to start looking in that direction. And when we do, just changing our way of thinking so it's not all filtered through party loyalty or party hatred makes for better activism, because we can say, you did good stuff, we're going to reward you, and you did bad stuff, we're going to punish you. You're not on our team, with us or against us. You know, thank you for the bill on mercenaries. Will you publicly commit to voting no on the next $33 billion for wars because we need that money? And if you don't, we're going to give you hell. I think we get better activism and we get less focus on the elections and more on the in-between the elections. You know, unelecting people is easier in general elections than in party primaries. But if we have to just switch between parties to do it, you know, it's not ideal. The ideal ought to be electing the best person and electing anybody who's not the best person. So, you know, we have to undo that Supreme Court decision. We also have to undo the power of the Supreme Court to make such decisions. We have to put the powers that have been claimed by the Supreme Court and the President back in the Congress, force the Congress to represent us. The reforms that are included in my book include putting the Senate finally out of its misery. Has never served any useful purpose. Expanding and improving the House, you know, but even a short baby step that's quite easy would be to get rid of the filibuster. And if the Democrats tell you they don't have complete power in Washington, you tell them that you know that the filibuster excuse is an excuse, that 50 of them in the Senate can get rid of it. Now, there's an argument that they have to do it at the beginning of a term. There's an argument that they can do it any day. But there's no dispute that they can do it. 50 senators can throw the thing out. A rule that lets, you know, 41 wealthy white guys who represent 11% of the country block all legislation can't be defended by anybody. Now, you get rid of it, then the 11% becomes 17%. The Senate is still rotten, but you've taken a significant step. But that I think, is the only reason that I would recommend to you that you remain aware that the Senate exists. And I would highly recommend forgetting that the President exists and try to go a week being a good, involved citizen without thinking about the President. And I know it's very, very hard, and all your questions will be about the President, and I'll have to talk about him and so forth, but it would open up new ways of thinking to drop the President and to think about the House of Representatives and Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky and all of your representatives in other districts and around the state. Because if you want to subpoena and impeach and hold accountable and engage in oversight, you only need a House committee, which is the easiest thing to get at. Extremely hard, very unfairly hard, but the easiest. If you want to deal with health care, you only need the House. That sounds crazy given the health care debate and discussion that we have, but when the bills are worse than nothing, as all the bills are, then you only need to stop them until they can do better. And to stop a bill, you only need the House. And which brings me to the final thing I want to say something about, which is the wars. Because there are a number of lovely bills in both houses to express their opposition to the wars, to say we shouldn't have the wars, to disagree with escalating one of the wars, to create a war tax to pay for the wars, and so forth. And yet, talking about bills as a way to deal with wars is not, I think, the best way to do it. What would be a better approach? What? Exactly. Instead of passing a bill to say we don't want to fund the wars, just don't fund the wars. And when you don't fund something, you just don't do it in the House. And then the Senate and the President can, you know, do as many wars as they want, but they can't do any without the House. We only need the House. And last June, when Jan Schakowsky let us down, we were within 5 votes of stopping the war money. Because they put in a crazy measure that made all the crazy Republicans commit treason by their own definition for year after year. They said voting against war money is treason, and they did it. They all voted against the bill because of something else that was in it. And then you only need 40 Democrats to vote no, and you stop it. And we had already had 51 of them vote no for show before the other thing was added in the Senate. So we held on to 31, and we needed 39 at that point. Maybe we needed 8 more. And Jan Schakowsky let us down, you know, faked a no vote and then voted yes when it mattered. This time, they may, quite likely, they're talking about it, put moving our most famous death camp from Cuba to Illinois in the bill with the $33 billion for war. Because they think this is a clever way to get the Republicans to vote for moving Gitmo to Illinois, or at least to pass it without them. Of course, the Republicans would all vote no if they do this. And we will, again, only need 40 Democrats to vote no. We're at 1,000 U.S. deaths in Afghanistan today, by the way. You can recall the outrage and the mobilization when we hit 1,000 deaths in Iraq, which were, you know, the wrong kind of deaths. They were Republican Bush deaths at that point. And I think, you know, getting these people to really put their foot down on the war money is the hardest thing for them, because it's where all the corporate power is. I was reading a book today about President Kennedy, and on August 12th of 1963, this is just months before he was killed, U.S. News had a headline that said, "If peace does come, what happens to business?" Right, because Kennedy was moving dramatically toward peace, for which he was killed, and yet we've got people across the country going to Congress members' district offices and demanding that they publicly commit to voting no, putting it on paper, putting it on video. If you go to defundwar.org, you get a list of where every Congress member is, where they've been, what they've committed to, what reports back we've gotten from constituents. And if you go to brownbaggers.org or pdamerica.org or United for Peace and Justice or Code Pink or any number of other places, you'll find out something called brown bag vigils. And people have started going at lunchtime with a brown bag lunch to their Congress members' district office and having a vigil to demand no more money for the wars, money for all the things we need it for. And, you know, we've gotten a lot of commitments. We've gotten a lot of sort of hedging, unsure answers. But we've gone from 22 vigils in January to 65 or more in February to clearly it's going to be over 100 in March, March 17th. And none of them, I think, in Illinois, at least not that I know of. Not that everybody here isn't going after their Congress members, but it would be nice to have this national organized effort grow into something where we're going after every office. And by the time this war bill comes, people have gone twice or three times and haven't gotten satisfaction and are willing to go into that office and sit there and not leave. Which, you know, I know the laws and the risks differ and you should be informed and use your judgment, but where I live, it's easy and enjoyable and one of the most pleasant experiences you can engage in to go with your friends to jail and force your Congress member to turn around. So I would encourage people to join in that, and also to come to Washington if you can. You know, if you have to choose, do it here. It's worth more to do it here. And I know you've got a march here on March 18th, but there's a march in D.C. on March 20th, and more importantly, disruptive nonviolent actions in Washington all through the month of March. And on March 19th, In Charlottesville, Virginia, where I live, people are coming from around the country to welcome Mr. Torture Lawyer John Yoo at the University of Virginia, which is going to be a lot of fun. So I want to stop and take questions, but I just want to give you a quote that I put in the front of the book from a guy named I.F. Stone, who said, "The only kinds of fights worth fighting are those you are going to lose, because somebody has to fight them and lose and lose and lose until someday somebody who believes as you do wins. In order for somebody to win an important major fight 100 years hence, a lot of other people have got to be willing, for the sheer fun and joy of it, to go right ahead and fight, knowing you're going to lose. You mustn't feel like a martyr. You've got to enjoy it." Thank you.